Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Okay, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Greg. Why don't you tell us what we have on tap?
All right, a great set of questions on questions about religious beliefs, the power of fiction, trusting a therapist, and more.
Yeah, it's a nice set of questions. I think there's lots of interesting meat in these. If you're listening live, folks, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live. And I do know that the mood meter is broken. Hopefully I will be able to get that fixed sometime this week.
Okay, what's been going on?
I've been a bit overwhelmed with personal matters, so I've been working on getting myself and my life in order. And then yesterday I got run into during sparring in Krav, and so I strained my triceps tendon, so I'm working on straightening and bending my arm in the appropriate way. It's just swollen. It should be fine. On Monday, when I will go back for more punishment.
Someone's teeth got in the way of your elbow. Is that something like that?
Not yeah. It was just, man, they were having a good time. The boys were, and they ran into us. So, you know, it happens.
All right.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I just like my standard policy after a Krav class is like, okay, how much ice do I need? And like how much pain am I in? And then the next day, generally things are fine. But you have to have a tolerance for that, I think.
Gotta love it.
I know, I do.
All right. So anything else?
I think that's it. Let's get started.
Okay. Questions about religious beliefs. How should a doctor respond to questions about her religious beliefs? My wife recently told me about a colleague of hers, a physician and an atheist, being caught off guard when asked by the parents of one of her cancer patients in the hospital if she believed in God. These parents wanted their son treated only by a doctor who believes in God, and my wife's friend did not qualify. How should she have answered their question?
Yeah, absolutely. There's an obligation to answer honestly here. I mean, I really think as a moral matter, as a legal matter, as a practical matter, you shouldn't deceive your patients, and you shouldn't want to deceive them. And this includes times when they are asking you irrelevant, stupid, and super annoying questions, when they're being basically wrong. Nonetheless, dishonesty is not the solution. So legally, I think that you might expose yourself to liability by lying if that ends up being discovered. There was a kind of false pretense in your relationship. But more than that, if anything goes wrong, if their son dies or the treatment doesn't go well or there's horrible side effects or something, a jury might reasonably take your lie about your religious beliefs as a reason not to believe you about anything else. So that's certainly not a course you want to take. Morally speaking, you should be respecting the autonomy of your patients. They have a moral right to make decisions about their medical care based on completely irrelevant factors, whether that's belief in unicorns or belief in God. So you need to be an honest trader here, not somebody who's trying to manipulate people into doing business with you. And then practically, you really don't want to be put in a, if you're an atheist, you really don't want to be put in a position where you're asked to pray with your patients, right? That's just icky. Like, why would you?
Yes.
Why would you can't possibly be that desperate for patients. So, ick, don't do that.
No, don't need any of that. All right. So, how best to finesse this? How should a doctor approach this?
Yeah, I think this is a matter of tact. This is a matter of kindness. So that's the moral consideration here. So there's a couple options. For one, you can answer the question very directly, very sort of bluntly, but kindly, right? You could say, look, I'm sorry, but I don't believe in God. Would you like me to put you in touch with Dr. X? He's a Christian, I think, right? He's a good doctor and he's a Christian. That would solve your problem. You can also, I think, decline to answer the question because it is personal, it is intrusive, and you can reasonably not wish to have conversations about your religious beliefs with your patients. So you could say something like the following. You know, I really like to leave my patients to their own religious beliefs. I don't select my patients based on their religious beliefs, and I don't think that patients should do that with their doctors either. But, you know, look, if you want a new doctor, that's fine. I can help make that happen.
Yeah, I kind of like that because it turns it into a bit of a teachable moment. You're making your boundary clear and letting them choose their own.
Yeah, and you're making it clear how, like, how ridiculous it would be if doctors were like, I'm sorry, you're not Catholic, I won't have you as my patient. These same people would probably be super offended. So, you know, but look, if they really want a religious doctor, they really want a religious doctor. And you shouldn't push too much on that score, right? You don't want them to accept you grudgingly and then to, again, to sue you when things go wrong.
Yeah, but I do like it, though, because you're saying, this is so irrelevant, I refuse to even talk about it. Right. If you really want somebody who wants to talk about God, I'll go find one for you.
Right, right.
All right, so this isn't just a problem with doctors and religion, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same problem if you're a software engineer and you're being asked about your political views in some very lefty, you know, business, or if a person asks you, you know, a fellow congregant in your church asks you about your views on abortion or homosexuality, and you know that the church is very conservative and you think that they're going to use this against you in some way. Here you have every right to decline to answer. You can say, look, I don't like to talk about my political views, or I'm not, you know, or deflect the question in some other way. But if you are going to answer, you need to be honest about your views, and you should be tactful about your views, the views of others.
Yeah. I have two anecdotes on this front. One coworker, a software engineer type, who was looking at a professorship, and he was clearly being screened by the people talking with him to see if he was a leftist, and he kind of brushed it aside, but still he thought it was kind of sad. And Tammy here, she actually had some of this happening implicitly at her workplace, where somebody set up a big prayer group study churchy kind of thing and sent out the invitation for everybody to join. And so now you have somebody who's in kind of mid-level management judging people's work, who also is judging whether or not you show up to his Bible study group or whatever. Not cool.
Right. Right. Yeah, I would certainly.
When Tammy she doesn't want anything to do with that at work.
Right.
And why can't they do their Bible meeting somewhere else?
I remember us talking about that. Is that still a problem? Did that get resolved in some fashion?
He left.
Oh, the fellow's no longer working there.
Yeah, that's
problem solved.
All good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All good.
Anyway, so these kinds of screenings seem to happen a lot.
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, sometimes people, like, you know, they just want to know, like, are you my kind of person? And my kind of person includes being liberal or being anti-abortion or being religious.
Yeah.
And I certainly, I mean, it's in a way, it's understandable that people who are deeply religious, let's say if their son is undergoing cancer treatment and it's going to be a long haul, that although I wouldn't agree with the religious beliefs, that having somebody who shares your views and could, you know, thank God at appropriate moments and so on, that might be meaningful. That might make this long process more endurable for them. So be a little bit sympathetic. Paul says in the chat, in residency, we were told that we could say the following, quote, I don't like talking about my own beliefs, but I will take care of you to the best of my ability. But if you want another doctor, we can find one for you, close quote.
Oh. Landed on exactly the one we like, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently there's a variant if the patient asks for a doctor of a specific race or sex. So, yeah.
Interesting.
That's all reasonable. I mean, you could certainly have somebody who would ask about, let's say, like sexual orientation or something like that. You know, I don't want to be treated by no gay doctor. Or, like, I have to have a gay doctor.
The wrong skin color or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yikes, people. They're so goofy. Okay, what's the take-home point?
The doctor should never lie, but she can choose to either answer the question honestly or refuse to answer it. If a patient wishes to behave irrationally, let him, right? I will say, when you're asked a question like this, this can be really awkward, and even if you have a prepared answer, it can be like, oh, God, what am I going to say? So, like, don't beat yourself up if you stumble a little bit. Take a deep breath before answering. But it's the kind of thing that you should have a standard prepared answer. Even if it's going to happen just on occasion, I think that can be helpful.
Yeah. My prepared answer is, oh, sorry, I'm not superstitious. No. That's only for the street people who come up and want to give me a pamphlet or something like that. That's a good one. Okay, so any follow-up action here? Not seeing.
Paul's comment of, please, I don't want to be treated by an Ohio State fan. Paul being a Michigan fan.
And that's the thing, when someone's being a goofy human, you never know what criteria they're going to make important that they shouldn't or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
And somebody, KPOM, noted in the chat, I could imagine that in certain settings, one might want a doctor of a specific sex, for example, in one's gynecologist or urologist. And that's certainly my, like, I have a, I've never seen a male gynecologist, and I don't know that I ever could, right, like that. And, like, I've just sort of accepted that bit of sexism about myself, like, sorry. And but if I were in an emergency situation, if I were in the ER, I would suck it up. But certainly if I had a choice, unless there was going to be a dramatic, a substantial and important difference in quality, I would choose a woman.
So. Interesting. Yeah, I don't really have a preference in my gynecologist. So.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you. Yeah.
All right. It's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just a live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. You can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember. You also get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that at philosophyinaction.com/support.
The power of fiction. Why does fiction arouse such a powerful emotional response? Why are people moved emotionally by literature and movies, even though they know that they're fiction? Shouldn't people respond emotionally only to real events, not products of imagination? Is there a rational basis for our emotional response to fiction?
So this is like, hello, rationalism. How are you
doing?
Right? And we'll see why we say that in a little bit here. I think the easy answer here is that, well, look, imagination, imagining things reminds us of them in real life. We connect with fiction. So even though we know that it's not real because it's similar to real life, we feel that it could be real. And so there is this kind of connection, emotional connection there. But I think I think that answer is right. I don't have any great problems with that answer. But I think there's a more complex answer, too. The purpose of emotions is, and of the mind more broadly, is not just to respond to reality as it is right now, right? We are not shellfish. We are not creatures that are stuck in a series of present moments. We have these great, big, fabulous brains, and they enable us to reflect back on the past and project into the future. And that's actually really, really important for survival. And it's actually really, really important that our emotions are connected to that, that they're not merely for recalling or imagining things, but I misstated that. That it's important that our emotions are connected to those both the reflections and the imaginations. We wouldn't want to just recall or just imagine. We want that to be emotionally laden. So imagine if I recollect time that I spent with a good friend and how much I enjoyed that. Like here I'm feeling, I'm feeling a bit blah and maybe I don't want to go out, but I want to, when I recall that memory, I want to feel the pleasure that I experienced. I want to feel like this echo of pleasure that I experienced when I was out with them, because that's going to motivate me to get off my big fat butt and go seek their company again. Right? So that's the emotion is motivating. That's really important. Or for example, let's say I'm out camping or I live out in the mountains and I'm thinking about how dark it is outside and how that dark might contain mountain lions. It's really good idea for that to contain fear in that imagining. Right? That's going to help keep somebody safe.
Yeah, nice kitty. Projection and then feeling emotion about what we project, that seems like it's critical for motivation and goal setting. Without that, I don't think we'd be pursuing long-term goals.
Yeah, think about doing something really hard and difficult, some big long-term project. You have to be emotionally invested in the end goal in order to keep yourself going, because you just can't rationally say, well, I know that I ought to do this and have that actually work. You need to have the emotional investment there. And it really, it's not just about fears here. That's what we ended up talking about that first in our production meetings, but that, because I think that's an obvious case that, like, if I'm going down this path, I really do want to be imagining the lion and I want to be feeling fear. That's actually going to keep me safe. But it's a lot is here is there's a lot about the positive outcomes of actions too. You have to want them. You have to want those end results. You have to be able to imagine them and think about how great it would be to have them in order to pursue them. So basically, the mind is projecting a past or a possible future into reality, and the mind is experiencing that again. And yes, part of that, it's automatic, it's not even something we have choices about, is experiencing emotions about that.
Yeah, and well, this will actually dovetail into something that's fun to talk about. So fiction is different because it's definitely not real. You know it's not real. So what's happening in that case?
Yeah, so what I think fiction is, it's just imagination kind of like folded onto itself about six different times again and again to make something very, very complex and rich. So fiction allows us to live the lives of others, to live life through their eyes and experience things that we wouldn't be able to experience normally. And that has a lot of major cognitive, emotional, and moral benefits. It, for example, it gives us a perspective beyond our own experience. It gives us a better way to understand ourselves and others. It gives us motivation to strive for better in our own lives. It gives us an inductive base for principles, moral and otherwise, and so on. And for these and other reasons, fiction really helps us become better humans. And what it's doing, the reason why we have these powerful responses to fiction, is because we have taken this imagination capacity of humans. It's this capacity with important survival implications. And what we've done is we've taken it to extremes in fiction. And we do that because we're human, because we have this amazing rational capacity. That's what enables us to take imagination and really do something crazy and wild and special with it. And still have that, the result of that, have also interesting survival implications as well.
Yeah, there's a nice analogy to the different operations or capacities of our minds or whole bodies that I remember learning from David Kelly, one of his lectures. And it came to the question of like, well, okay, suppose you have an analogy of a race car. Rationality is great for us, but why do you need like a cooling system and air conditioning for the, you know, the guy in the main compartment and all that? And the answer there was that, well, while it's not the direct source of power, it's not like the spark plugs or the fuel itself, it's definitely necessary to the operation of the vehicle, especially if it needs to go run really hard or long. So the cooling system to cool down the engine is definitely necessary, and emotions could be like that, or even more, it could be an upgrade to something that's already pretty powerful. It could be like a turbo injector. Going further.
Right. Yeah, that's what I would think. I would think having imagination linked with emotions is like the cooling system. It's a necessary part. You want this thing to survive for long. You need this.
Yep.
Whereas fiction is like this turbo injector. It's something added, something extra that makes things much better. And what?
Yeah, given that we have the first capacity, when we fold it in on itself, like to use your lingo, that's the upgrade. That's
right.
It's a wonderful upgrade.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, so as for the rationalism of this question, I think that what's happening here is the questioner is just looking very narrowly at the way the mind functions and the survival value of those functions. But there's so much more complexity in the human mind. There's so many times where the way in which we survive using reason, like feeding that is also has survival value. And so you need to look more broadly. And you need to respect the value of emotions here too, which is something rationalists tend not to like to do. But you need to respect that reason has its own needs then, and then those requirements of reason have their own needs and so on. So you get this cycling back. It's not a simple and easy answer.
Yeah, and actually in the case of fiction and having an emotional response, you can take it as a sign of a well-integrated person that their emotions are properly trained. You can, now, while you're reading the story, you can go, yes, this is a hero, and I'm responding positively to the heroic actions of this hero. That's good. That's a sign I'm well-integrated. I like that. That means that when you're in an everyday circumstance or projecting something out into the future in real life, you know that you can trust that your emotions are going to do the right thing. And, nudge you in the right directions.
Yeah, there's definitely kind of moral training involved in fiction. Now, I will say, like, this point about the rationalism and how the mind functions and so on, this is a non-obvious point, and it's actually in our production meetings. It took us a while, because I had two separate production meetings, and in both cases, it took us a while to cycle to this point. And what we had to do was ask ourselves, like, what's the value of imagination more broadly? Let's look at a bunch of cases in which we're using imagination and its survival value, and how is that connected to emotions? And then we tackled the question of fiction. And so it's not like when I say that, look, this is rationalism, that doesn't mean it's easy to fix or that the right approach is clear and obvious from the get-go. In fact, not at all. Sometimes working through the facts takes time and effort. So
yeah,
don't, literally. You know, if you've been confused about this issue, don't feel bad. It's all right.
No, and even it might sound like we're chiding someone, but really, it's at first blush we're like, wow, this has kind of a smell of rationalism, and we still had to fall back on the okay, where is the value in this? What's really going on? And that's the circling we had there. So actually, it was a very interesting question. So I really appreciate it.
Right.
All right. What's the take home point?
So people should respond emotionally, and they do, in fact, respond emotionally to the products of the imagination. That has major survival value, and fiction is just the result of that capacity taken to the extreme.
Excellent. Okay, Tom asks, is becoming emotionally involved in fiction ever harmful?
Yes. I mean, for one, people can have emotional responses to fiction that are wrong or uncalibrated. I mean, people can have very strong emotional responses to fiction and not want to do anything else and not do anything else with their life. So they're kind of engaged in some kind of escapism, or they can have emotional reactions to fiction that are uncalibrated and wrong in various ways. But I don't think that's always obvious from the surface. I mean, so for example, I as literature, I love the Gospels. Love them. They're fabulous.
Oh, dang it. You stole my thunder. I was going to say, well, these people are, I know a bunch of people who are really involved in one work of fiction that seems harmful. Oh, no.
But like, there's a difference between how I love the Gospels and how the Christian loves the Gospels, right?
Yeah.
And you cannot simply say to somebody, well, you love the Gospels, like, that means you're wrong. Or, like, how could you possibly do this? This is obviously harmful. No. It depends on a lot about what you know and what your individual context is and what you get out of the fiction and so on. Oh, see, now Kelly Elmore loves John, and she's just wrong.
John.
Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And actually, well, it should be Mark, Matthew, and Luke, since Mark was the one that was written earliest. And Mark is actually my favorite because it's so like, weirdly... weirdly wrong as a story. Like, I love the literary story. The whole message is, like, nobody understands Jesus, right? Here's this man. He's trying to teach his disciples, and they will not learn. And he's trying to teach other people, and they, like, nobody understands this man. And then at the very end, you know, like the original ending is just he emerges from the tomb, and the women run away from him, scared, and tell nobody. And nonetheless, we still have, you know, we have this gospel, we have all the history and so on. And it's obviously, it's obviously there. And it's funny because I think it's actually true. Like if Jesus were resurrected and came back, he would pretty much be like, what the hell? What have you done? You crazy people. Didn't you read Mark? What's the matter with you? Why don't you understand me? Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see, to go back to Tom's question, it seems like it could be harmful if you become confused about what's made up and what's real, or
right.
Yeah, you just invest way too much significance in the characters, and it ends up mistraining your emotions in reality.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yikes. Okay. Oh, and by the way, Kelly says that based on your comment there, she's splitting with you now. You're going to be Facebook unfriended, and yeah, we have a whole
Yeah, we have a schism. You know, I have a list of like 100 things that objectivists had and have schismed over. I'm going to add this one to the list. And I need to, we had this idea.
You preferred the wrong gospel.
I know. Mm. Yeah, that's it. Isn't that awesome? So at AliceCon some years ago, we had this idea of creating what would be your schism number. So basically every place in the number would refer to one of the schism items, and your number would refer to the number that was in it, the digit that was in it, would refer to which position you actually took on that, because sometimes there's more than two. And so,
oh, okay. I was going to say, usually this would be a binary number.
No.
Okay.
And then we can compare numbers and see, like, you could just, like, present somebody with your schism number and immediately see all the areas in which you agree and disagree, and then you could decide whether they're evil evaders or not just based on that.
Okay, so geeky question. Are the higher orders of magnitude in this number positions earlier in time or positions of fundamentality?
I hadn't ordered them that. Like, it was things were ordered in the way Diana thought of them. So that was how that worked. We actually hadn't. Well, like, this was just an idea. I haven't worked it out yet. We do really need to do this sometime. That would be really funny. Yeah.
That would be quite hilarious. Okay.
And then there has to be a schism number. Or like, one of the digits has to be like, do you find this whole thing offensive? Right.
The whole idea
of the schism number, right? And yep. Making fun of it and so on. Because there's definitely people who'd be like, this is wrong. Yeah.
There are some people who get me. Kelly got what I just asked.
Yep.
Like it. Thank you. Okay, so next up, Tom asks, can you judge a person's character by what kinds of fiction they enjoy?
No.
You need to know why they enjoy it.
Yeah, you need to know why they enjoy it. I mean, again, like, here, you know, Kelly and I could argue about which gospel is the best, right? And it depends on your reasons for liking this fiction. And there's certainly, I really like a lot of fiction that other objectivist friends of mine hate. And I like it because it's difficult and it's challenging and it's this very different worldview from my own. And they're looking, like, they don't want that. They're looking for something that fits their worldview, that's more in the vein of spiritual fuel rather than challenge. And so, yeah, we would have big disagreements about, you know, whether Anna Karenina is, you know, completely evil and awful or wonderful and fabulous and also awful. So.
All I need to know about you is whether you enjoy reading about vampires. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know what the whole thing
is. Like, if there's any vampire show on TV, I will totally watch it.
Really? Oh, and zombies, right?
Yeah, zombies and vampires. I like all the supernatural vein stuff.
Yeah, I got kind of bored with it. It just so much of it out there.
It makes me super happy that there's so much of it out there now. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. See, Kelly.
Well, that's it. Another skip.
Oh, okay. Another skip.
I'm splitting with you. Yeah.
Okay.
No more supernatural stuff.
Look, I'm writing this down so that I can add it to my.
I think it's death worship. Yeah, I can tell it already.
There we go. Okay.
You have death premise running through you.
Yes.
Okay. So somebody else commented, people should respond emotionally to products of the imagination. Wait, what the? What happened here? 6 years. Okay, I don't know what that is. But Kelly, Tom asks, do you think enjoying fiction is required for a healthy psychology?
No. I think that there's some people who really don't resonate with fiction, and Greg, you're one of them.
Huh?
I thought you were one of them. You're not a big fan of reading Ayn Rand's fiction. You read all the nonfiction first.
Oh, true. I was more, yeah. I read all the nonfiction before any of the fiction. It was,
yeah.
Or I went through the whole system before I went, okay, and she wrote novels, huh? All right. But yeah. I'm much better. I airplane books and the occasional... Okay. Novel. Tammy's much better read than me on the classics now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that I knew. But no, I don't think that you have to enjoy fiction. I think that there can be personality reasons why you don't find that super appealing. I mean, I'm a huge enjoyer of fiction. I really love fiction, but I can understand if somebody is not.
Or the fiction I enjoy the most is still something rooted in reality. It teaches me something.
You thought Galt's speech was the best part of Atlas Shrugged, right?
I enjoyed it a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
Very dense work.
Like, that makes me want to stab my eyeballs out. So,
well, I didn't think it was a great work of literature. I just thought it was a wonderful
No, I know, but there's...
I was like, wow, you spent years putting this into a novel. Hell yeah.
See, there's people who love Atlas Shrugged and get to Galt's speech and are like, oh, sweet Jesus, no, I can't take it anymore. And then there's people who read Atlas Shrugged and they're like, yes, finally, like, this is the best part. And that's true, like, of all the speeches and so on. And so,
I love the money speech. It's like, that was awesome speech.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, yeah, lay it out, man. Lay it out.
That's so you. Yeah, so that's not...
I did spend my youth reading a lot of sci-fi and things like that. And I had a kind of a switch from reading lots of sci-fi and fantasy to reading none.
Right.
And then much, much later, you know, oh, and she wrote a novel too, huh? Okay, yeah. I'll go read that.
So speaking of sci-fi and fantasy, I'll give a general recommendation from a book that I really, really enjoyed, because I don't read much sci-fi and fantasy anymore because so much of it sucks. But The Martian, which is actually coming out as a movie with Matt Damon, phenomenal. And I really, really enjoyed the audiobook. So if, you know, sci-fi geeky types among you, this is, it's super awesome, really fun, well worth reading, and, like, just really heroic, and it's both heroic and very down to earth. Like, this person is clearly, like, you know, an amazing person, and his perseverance is and ingenuity is just overwhelming. And yet he's also just such a real person in this novel. So highly, highly recommend that.
Wow. Okay. Finally, Tom asks, which disc types would enjoy fiction more, do you think?
I don't know. You know, I tend to think that people who are people-oriented rather than thing-oriented, so high I, high S, might be more interested in fiction than the high D, high C axis. But I don't know. Like, I mean, I know a lot of high Cs who really like fiction. Like, Paul is high C, and he reads a ton of fiction. He really loves it. So that's certainly nothing like a hard and fast rule.
Interesting. Okay, why don't you remind listeners about your book, Responsibility and Luck?
So my first book, Responsibility and Luck, A Defense of Praise and Blame, is available for purchase in paperback and Kindle formats. The book defends the justice of moral praise and blame of persons using an Aristotelian theory of moral responsibility, thereby refuting Thomas Nagel's problem of moral luck. It's an academic work, but it's accessible to anyone with an interest in philosophy. And for details, including For details, including free preview chapters, visit philosophyinaction.com/moral luck.
Mute error. Okay. Trusting a therapist. How can I trust a therapist to help me? I have psychological problems, and I probably need help. However, I have a negative view of the mental health profession in general due to bad experiences in the past. It bothers me that therapists are educated in modern universities where all forms of leftism and equally irrational psychological theories predominate. In my state, many licensed counselors are just social workers, the most leftist whack job profession of all time, with government licenses to counsel people. I'm afraid that they will have me involuntarily committed if I'm honest about my thoughts of suicide, which I have ready plans to carry out if I decide to. How can I trust anybody in this effing profession?
Yeah, so the first thing I would say is it's not the case that you probably need help, as you say at the beginning of this question. If you have ready plans for suicide, then you definitely need the help of a good therapist. I mean, really, I'm really serious about that.
Yes.
Please, please, please go do what it is I'm going to tell you in a minute and find a good therapist who can help you. Because life can be better than being on the edge of the abyss. It really can. Second, I could understand your reluctance to seek out therapy if you'd had repeated bad experiences with therapists in the past. Therapy is this intensive investment of time and effort and money, and if it's not actually helpful, or worse, if it's actively harmful, then that's a real problem, right? And undoubtedly, there are lots and lots of stupid, wrong, crazy therapists out there. But that's not the kind of reservations that are given in the question here, so I find that a bit puzzling. The reservations, particularly the philosophic ones, are about the influence of leftism and other irrational theories in universities, about many, many of these people being social workers and so on. And those seem just like excuses. I mean, yes, those reservations would apply to some therapists, but they are far, far from being universal in the profession. And in fact, this came up with my own therapist recently, because I was asking her for articles on a particular topic, and she said, you know, like, she's so far out of the academic world, like, so much of what she's doing has been based on her experience in therapy with clients, basically inductive experience, not from, you know, whatever theory she read about when she was in school. And a good therapist, that's what's going to happen to them. They're gonna let go of those theories and work with the inductive data that they have, which is from their clients in therapy. So I think here you really need to let go of your concerns about the profession as a whole. Focus on individual therapists. Look for the better ones, the ones with better ideas and better practices. Greg? Mute error again?
Yes, a mute error. I've been out of practice for a whole week, and you know, just destroys everything. Okay, so what I was saying that you couldn't hear was, what can a person do to find one of those better therapists?
I think actually one of the first things that you can do is ask for recommendations from friends. Greg, I've got echo problems here. Sorry. We'll have more mute errors in future then. So ask for recommendations from friends. That can oftentimes be really, really helpful. These are people who've had experience with a therapist. They're people that you could trust. Hopefully they'll people who can give you some good ideas. Then go and look at their websites. Check out their specialties. You definitely want someone who's versed in your issues. Oftentimes there's a lot of clues on their website to their views and approach. They'll have articles posted that either they've written or articles that they like. They'll have explaining their therapeutic approach, some of the techniques they use, and that kind of thing. And if that's not enough, if the website is a bit sparse, then email them requesting an article or summary of their therapeutic approach. You can also look at Yelp reviews too, and those are, they're going to be of mixed quality, but oftentimes you can get a sense for what being that person's client would be like. Ultimately, I think you can rule out people this way. I certainly did when I was looking for a therapist. There was quite a number that I was, particularly there was one who was religious, that it's like, no, yeah, that's totally not happening. But ultimately, you can't really tell until you try, so you're going to need to schedule a session. And in that session, you can lay out your major problem, see how they respond. You can notice what questions they ask or fail to ask. That was actually really important for me, for the therapist that I saw first, who I decided not to continue with, was A, some of the reasons that were given for why I would wish to stay in my marriage were insane. And just so wrong and so bad. And then also there were certain questions that this person failed to ask that I was like, wow, are you stupid? Like, I can't, if you couldn't ask me this question, there's so much more digging that I will, that I'll just be able to run circles around you. So really pay attention to that. Also, I think you can ask questions about what their approach is, what to expect. Ask them, when would the therapy end? Like, what's the purpose? And if somebody says, well, look, this is a lifelong enterprise, like run the other direction, right? You want to have specific goals in mind. You want to be able to do the therapy and then be done with it. And this is the basic process that Paul and I used when we were finding therapists in the wake of our separation. And it's something I was reluctant to do therapy because I had had a bunch of bad experiences in the past. And the first therapist that I did try, I really, as I said, I really didn't like him. But then we found somebody who had been recommended by a friend, and then that person actually recommended somebody particularly for me. And I did all of these things, and lo and behold, it actually worked. So you can, it's possible to find a good therapist using this technique. And if a particular one doesn't work out, figure out, okay, what, were there clues I should have had? What's going on? Learn from that mistake and try again.
Indeed. Okay. There was the other concern. What about the concern that a therapist might report him for plans of suicide?
I think that might be a real concern here. Two things that I would say about that. One, as far as I understand, intent to commit suicide is what gets people locked up, not mere plans. So there's a difference between, well, if I were to commit suicide, I would do X, right? And saying something like, I plan to commit suicide tomorrow by doing X. There's a difference in those things. And it's the former will not get you a 72-hour hold, but the latter will. But, of course, it depends on the therapist, and it depends on what's,
you're at the mercy of kids. Yeah, plenty of kids out there thinking about, well, they're a little dark, and they're thinking about the best way to kill themselves. But it's not actually planning to kill themselves.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, there's a fine line there, and there's definitely a gradation, but there are differences there. I will say, if you're actively planning and this is something you are in danger of doing, there are worse things than ending up on a 72-hour hold. And risking that by going into therapy and trusting your therapist with this knowledge, that might be what you need to do to create a life that's actually worth living for yourself, a life where you're not on the edge of this abyss. And so even with these fears, I mean, this is the problem with mandatory reporting of suicidal people, is that they will not seek out therapy because they do not wish to be reported. And I understand that. But this might be as somebody who's the potential patient, you might say, look, I know that this is a possibility, but I need to take this risk because I don't want to keep living in the way that I'm living.
Yeah, and we've had a prior discussion of when one should take action regarding somebody who's looks like they're trying to kill themselves, intervening.
Right.
And so that kind of a fine judgment call for the therapist is actually a challenge. So that could be why they have the reporting rules. It's like, oh, we just want to take that out of your hands.
I don't know. I still think the therapist has to make a decision. And I've certainly, I've had conversations about this where the therapist was inquiring a little bit more about what my state of mind was and so on. So, you know, like they do not wish to report their clients any more than you wish to be reported. And they certainly do not wish to report too soon because that could destroy the therapeutic relationship. So, if you have a good therapist, they're going to try to be sensitive and make a good judgment there. And if, I don't know, but still, like, I just think it's worth taking that risk. It's worth taking that risk.
Yeah. Okay. Challenging topic. What's the take-home point?
So you do definitely need the help of a good therapist, and you can find that by exercising your own powers of judgment and going about it in a way that is looking at individual therapists rather than at the profession as a whole. And please, please, please do that.
Indeed. Tom asks, do you think market forces will cull some of the most irrational psychologists since they won't be as effective as people who have practical advice?
I think actually that we already see this in academic philosophy, or not academic philosophy, in academic psychology has been at times in the grip of really, really insanely idiotic views like behaviorism. Like, there was a while in the 70s where everybody in academic psychology was a behaviorist. Everybody. And yeah, there were some therapists who were behaviorists, but it wasn't like that. And the reason is that the closer your contact to actual people and real-world problems, the more reality-oriented you have to be if you want people to pay you money. So it's one of the things that you see is the more removed a profession is from real-world concerns and people actually paying you to solve their real-world concerns, the more irrational it can get and the more in the grip of crazy-ass theories it can get.
Indeed. All right. If nothing else, we can move on. All right. It's rapid-fire question time where I put Diana on the hot seat, drawing questions from this long and growing queue in any old order I like, and she hasn't gotten to prepare so much and think about it, so we could get some interesting results here. Right off the top here, should I feel empathy for Greeks enduring the financial crisis? Sure, many people are innocent, but what of the majority that created the situation?
I still think you can feel empathy for them and say, like, wow, this really sucks for you. Even when you think you helped create this, for one,
yeah, it's like this sucks for you, but you made your bed.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can recognize. I think there's a kindness, both a kindness and a justice about recognizing. Look, wow, yeah, I mean, wow, this is bad for you, and I'm sorry that it's so bad for you, but you helped create this problem, and it's your job to clean it up. It's your responsibility. If somebody is trying to, like, woe is me, and I still don't want to pay the consequences of what we've done, that's another problem. I will also say that ordinary people, you know, they had just been told that they could borrow and spend and borrow and spend ad infinitum, and that this was actually the road to prosperity. And if ordinary people don't understand that, I don't fault them too much for that.
Yeah, kind of like a certain economy, we know that we're stimulating ourselves to prosperity.
Right.
Continuously. Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, if America has another financial crisis, are you and I, Greg, to blame? I don't know. Like, even
not,
if we voted
directly.
For politicians currently in office, like, what else could we do? How many, like, did we really have better options?
Yeah.
But I do think there's a, when, particularly when you're, I don't know, when you're speaking with people and when you're being judgmental in this way, right? I think you can recognize, like, look, these are human persons and they're struggling and they're in a bad way. And taking that, like, godlike condemnatory approach is not necessarily going to help them face the facts about what they've done and solve their problems.
Yeah. If they're So if they're rejecting austerity measures from their debtors, there it seems appropriate to say, look, you've been enjoying yourselves eating up your principal, so to speak, as you experimented with these statist policies, and now the bill's coming due, and it's not cool to ask your debtors just to forgive that and let it go.
Oh yeah, no, I would agree with that.
So it's like you need to, one way or another, you have to pay the bill.
Yeah, it's I have much less sympathy for people who are trying to continue to evade the problem rather than confront it.
Yeah.
That's in a way like a whole different moral matter.
Yeah. Okay. So I have to ask this one to see if your first response is what I think it might be. Would it ever be technically possible for a moral dilemma to have no resolution? Can you imagine a problem context for which the better choice could never be deduced?
Yes. Yes, obviously so. I mean, Sophie's Choice is an example of this. You're in line at the train station and you're Jewish and the Nazi officer comes up to you and says, pick your son or your daughter to keep and I'm taking the other one. And if you don't choose, I'll take them both and kill them. I think that not choosing is actually a worse option in that case. But how is a parent are you supposed to decide which one is better, which child to keep? And I mean, there's other similar, you can imagine a trolley problem kind of case where it's not just like one person versus five, but it's like, let's say it's two sets of five strangers, where do you pull the lever? Do you not? Honestly, it doesn't matter because the outcomes are equivalently bad.
Yeah. No good solution. And maybe after you've had the solution, you can't even tell how it went.
Right.
Versus some other option. It's not even knowable. Okay. So
yeah, I generally think that these kinds of scenarios require a great deal of evil to construct, right? Like the Joker or Nazis. But it is sometimes the case that there's two bad options in life. And sometimes you have a worse option and a bad option and a worse option, and it's you definitely need to choose the bad option. But sometimes there's just two like really equally horrible options, and that would be a moral dilemma that has no resolution.
Yeah, and speaking of schisms, this has been a source of some schisms with objectivists, for example, right? You're facing a situation where, because of our government's policies, say, there are two bad solutions, and it's really a debate over, are these really both equally bad and it doesn't matter, or is one really a lot worse than the other, and which one?
One is bad and the other is apocalyptically bad. Yeah, that's the question. Yeah.
So this seems pretty common.
Yes.
All right, next up, this is interesting. Is there a way to cultivate faith, meaning unfailing trust in oneself and one's decisions in an uncertain world, without accepting religious dogma?
I wouldn't call that faith. And I've had a prior discussion of this, so you could go...
Confidence or something like that.
Yeah, confidence and trust in oneself. I also don't think you should have unfailing trust in yourself, because that implies you're just going to keep going along the same path and never question yourself, never ask whether you did the right thing, never try to do better, right? I think that one can have trust in oneself, but you also need to question and doubt and wonder and ask and not just keep plowing ahead no matter what.
And you need rational confidence, not just confidence.
Decisions are not always right, and sometimes it can be really hard to realize that you have seriously screwed up something big in your life, that you made not just one decision, but sometimes decision after decision after decision. And what's hard, I mean, that happens, right? Rational people do this, and rational people who were making an effort do this. And what you have to do is not let that completely undermine your confidence. So like, what's the point in even trying? Or like, I'm obviously a complete idiot. So you have to maintain the sense that I'm going to go forward. I'm going to, despite this error, I'm going to try to do better next time. But if you have this attitude of what I need is unfailing trust in myself and my decisions in an uncertain world, then that seems to me like I don't want to ever admit that I made a mistake, so I'm just going to persist in it. And that is the worst possible.
That's really dangerous. You should be cultivating the mental habits of rationality, where you really do try to make the best decision you can with the best information you have, and you monitor for errors and learn from your mistakes as you go. So
also, I think
develop a lot of confidence.
Yeah, you should recognize how certain you are about each decision that you make, right?
Yeah.
Some decisions you're really clear, this is absolutely what I want. And sometimes you're like, I don't know if this is what I want, but I'm going to test it out and see what happens. And so it's really important to know which is which.
Absolutely. If I don't really know the course I need to take and I choose one option and it doesn't work out, that's okay. I just look for factors that could help me make a better decision. If I'm super confident because I think I understand the domain and I think I'm certain that this is the right thing to do and it goes horribly wrong, that's a huge red flag. I examine the way I was looking at the whole problem because something went sideways. So that's definitely a big part of the feedback loop that you need to be running all the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so moving on. Hey, what's the response to the anarchist argument that we already have anarchy since different governments are in anarchy with respect to each other, you know, globally? I think that's what they mean.
So this is actually a point that Will Thomas used to make. And his point was, and look how well that works, right?
Yeah.
Look how well international relations work. Basically, what you see is the U.S. bullying every other country, including when we've been horribly, horribly in the wrong. And, you know, having an ally and then dropping the ally, basically how international relations work is exactly how, in fact, I have predicted.
It's a big gang war for a cluster.
That critics of anarchy say, look, this is what happens and this is why it's not good, where when force becomes a market commodity, it means that the highest bidder, the people with the most resources, get to dictate to everybody else. And that's not a good thing.
And it's generally just a matter of luck.
Right. And that's not a reason. Yeah.
Who's in charge?
That's not a reason to have a one world government, because I think that comes with its own grave perils. I mean, I think that there's questions about what sort of the reasonable size, both in geography and population, a country should be. I think that international relations are not a paragon of rationality and justice. So
no.
Anarchists,
not the anarchist utopia that they would like.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
All right. This person says, I find most of the government's decisions on how my forcibly collected tax dollars are spent to be morally reprehensible. Do I need to leave the U.S. to maintain my integrity?
No.
Oh, we need to talk about responsibility.
So,
cue the product placement.
Yeah. So this is relevant to my book in part. But if you are having your taxes forcibly collected from you, you do not have the power to say, I do not want to fund the welfare state. I do not want to fund our ridiculous, crazy immigration system. I do not want to fund our adventures in the Middle East. You do not have the power to do that, to withdraw your money. And so you are not responsible for how the U.S. is spending your tax dollars. And so it's not a matter of integrity for you. It's something that this is something that is being done to you. It's not something that you are doing. And so it can't possibly be that your integrity is compromised by what's being forced upon you. Here's how your integrity would be compromised. If you advocated for welfare state programs because, for example, your business would benefit by them, even though you know that they would that they're wrong. That would be a breach of integrity. Don't do that.
Indeed. This person asks, I can understand why there are so few objectivists among businessmen, but why are there so few businessmen among objectivists?
I don't know that that's true.
Hmm.
I don't know. I mean, the objectivists that I know, like there's a ton of software engineers, there's a ton of entrepreneurs in that crowd. I mean, a lot. There's academics, there's doctors, there's a wide variety of, I mean, it tends to be sort of upper end of the professional scale. That's not surprising. So I don't know that there's. I will say, like, the number of businessmen in the sense of, like, the Steve Jobs of the world, like, those amazing, like, wow kind of people, those people are really few and far between. So it's not surprising that none of those are objectivists, although John Allison and the work that he did at BB&T was pretty spectacular. So later work, not such a fan of, in terms of him taking over at Cato, but as a businessman, he was incredible, and he was an objectivist. So, yeah.
Okay. A little further down. Hey, why is it not acceptable to buy votes at the booth, but it is acceptable to promise financial gain for a class of voters after the politician gets elected? Seems like they're buying votes in both cases. Yeah.
Yeah, I think because one is very direct. A, for one thing, I'm not sure that it should be illegal to buy people's votes. I can't remember. I think we've discussed this before. Like, I just don't, like, go ahead and try, people. Right? Good luck with that. And I don't know that voters are voting for politicians because they think they're going to get all the goodies. I think some voters do, but I think voters are voting in large part with their ideological, based on their ideological views. I don't know. And also, like, who has the nicest tie, and he's got a really great smile. So it's hard to say. By the way, there's a question down here on Ayn Rand's ideal, which I think has just been published, so that might be relevant.
Oh, where is it?
I just bolded it. Pull down a little bit.
You know how long this list is?
I know.
See, I'm way down there picking out another
page
one.
Page 8 of 15.
Oh, my gosh. I'm down on... Yeah, this is a long... When I say it's a long and growing list, it is.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think of the publishing of Rand's ideal? Do you think its publication is motivated by a desire to spread Rand's ideas, or is it merely a publicity stunt?
I hope it's neither. Shouldn't
be about the author.
There's long time we've all had this. It's been published, this play version of Ideal, but as far as I understand, Rand wrote a novel version of it as well, and that is what is just being published. And so I haven't read it yet, but, like, dude, this is cool. Like, this should be out there. This should be out there in the world. So I think that should be the desire. That should be the motivating factor of, like, let's get this work. I mean, it's a related work to something we've had already, but this is cool that we can have this too. So let's get out in the world. Let's not keep this in some box somewhere. So I'm sure it's not a publicity stunt. I mean, I hope it's. I mean, one always hopes that people do appropriate publicity, right? But it's not like what we're going to, like, drop a bunch of copies of Atlas Shrugged off the Empire State Building with little parachutes on them. Like, that would be a publicity stunt. This is just, it's a new publication. I do think there've been some descriptions of it as a new book or a new work. And I can sort of understand that. That seems to be stretching the truth to me a little bit, but whatever. I'm glad it's out there.
Yeah. And hopefully if they're just ignoring the artistic merits and just putting it out there, that would be really stupid, because it would debase Rand's currency, as an artist,
right?
That would be a bad backfire. Okay. Tom Jones had a follow-up to earlier quickie. Would it be immoral to take money for a vote and then not vote that way?
I don't think so. I think that's one of the risks of buying votes. And this is one of the, like, issues with an enforceable contract, is that you have to have some way of knowing whether the other person has performed the contract or not. And so it actually would qualify perhaps as an unenforceable contract, in which case somebody can give you all the money they want, but you're not legally obliged to do what you promised to do.
Yeah, but morally wise, with respect to morality?
Somebody's going to buy my vote. Like that just seems really – like, the buying of the vote or accepting of that is the moral wrong, in a way. And so, like, what does it matter once you do after that? Except that, let's say it was this widespread practice, and, like, one side – let's say it was legally acceptable, and one side was trying to do a mass buy of votes. And one way of protesting that people could have would be to agree to have their votes bought and then go vote for whoever they actually wish to vote for. And that would be – I would like that. That would be good. That would be moral.
Yeah. Okay, and finally, is it wrong to take apart a device that you've bought just to understand it if the licensing agreement forbids it?
No. Go do it. Go have fun.
It's your thing.
I don't see that you're doing like, I understand why they have those licensing agreements that they do, because they're trying to cover their asses, but I just don't see that you're doing harm in any way, shape, or form to the business that you're licensing from in that case.
Okay. With that, we can move on. It's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I had a fantastic time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just email all that feedback to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
I'll forward it to Greg. Don't worry, folks.
Yeah, I get the good ones.
If you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. This show features Dr. Diana Brickle, and you can read her blog Noodle Food at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.